Lecture 20, looking outside, it's hard to believe, November 7th, here in Northeast Ohio, 2022. Lecture notes page is 178, I hope. So, you didn't like the idea of going to Greece for a little study abroad program. Okay, fine, how about going to Florence for a spring break trip? This is newly announced, study abroad in Florence over spring break, 2023. Business excellence and made in Italy is the topic. The course focuses on the fields contributing to the success of the made in Italy brand and label. The industrial design, luxury food, and fashion industries all contributed. You'll see through field trips how Italian products combine beauty and functionality for global commercial success. Sounds interesting? Click on the QR code or on the link to get to the program information or contact Teresa Wallace at kent.edu if that sounds interesting to you. You want to go somewhere, we're going to help you go. We've seen this before. It's just a reminder, digital marketing. Mini test 9 closed Saturday on its regular schedule. Average score 87%. 84%, that doesn't seem right. I think that's a typo because I think it was higher than 84% of the students took it. I think it was more like 89%. Yay. The last of the mini-tests before midterm 2 will open tomorrow on its regular schedule and close Saturday. And midterm 2 will open on Saturday and run through next Tuesday. Let's see. Enhanced learning and pack back number 7 are up and running, closing Wednesday. Overall, if you've participated in those, you've added 1.6% to your final course grade. Plus, if you participated in Research Extra Credit 1 and coming up 2, you'll have earned 2.6% to your final course grade. Good dig. So, Research Extra Credit number 2, I mentioned it last time, it's actually here. Using a PC or laptop, can't use a smartphone, mobile device. Complete the survey by Friday, November 11th at 11:59 p.m., so this coming Friday. Add an additional 0.5% to your course grade and help the researcher. The researcher tells me there will be attention check questions. Sometimes students aren't really being good participants. They're just going click, 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 all the way through. So here you have to get credit. You have to pay attention. And when it says, I don't know, is this green or blue, you have to click the right number, whatever her check questions are. So don't just mindlessly click on the questions. The details, I'll send out an email this afternoon after class, but they're already out in the extra credit module opening after 5 p.m. So participate in there. Add yourself some extra credit points. Why not? Midterm 2 is coming, 17% of your grade, covering lectures 11 to today, 20. And that's what's covered in mini test 6 to 10 without any marketing or business in the news questions. Because we're going to focus on content. You can review the material in the review tests. Opening Saturday at 8 a.m., closing on Tuesday at 6 p.m. Note the closing time. Questions on the midterm? We already know the new rules, and so I don't think I have to say too much about that. No digital devices were anywhere near you. That way there's no explanation. You don't have to explain why I'm seeing one. And don't be looking up and down, side to side, over the top of the computer screen, because it's suspicious. So just take the test or contact me to set up a in-person private tutoring session. So, business in the news. We all know Hershey's, and they're a pretty good company. And if I asked you what is Hershey's known for, what product, what would you say? Chocolate, right? So it turns out, sure, they're still a chocolate company, but they've turned themselves around by redefining their business. So let's take a look at this. How did Hershey double the value of its stock in 5 years, outperform tech giants over 3 years, beat more than 450 companies in the S&P 500 this year, and avoid the recent market meltdown? It turns out that Hershey's success was based on becoming more American and less reliant on chocolate. The company had to rethink what business it was in and where that business should be. Both of these decisions that they made were surprising in their own ways. So here was their strategy for success. The first decision was spending billions of dollars on, of all things, salty snacks, like popcorn, cheese puffs, and pretzels. Hershey went on a spree of buying Skinny Pop, Pirate's Booty, Dots Home-Style Pretzels, and Pretzels, Inc., Over several years, for the reasons familiar to any sentient meeting, anybody who thinks, the company had a craving for sweet and salty. So we see growth via acquisition and product development, new products to existing consumers. The second move was more contrarian. Hershey's bucked the conventional wisdom and its own history by scaling back internationally and sharpening its competitive edge at home, domestically. So it's a risky play. It's their corporate strategy and an interesting reversal of the idea of global marketing. Back in 2006, when the stock was trading below 100, Mondelez offered to pay $107 and then $115 a share in a deal that would have created the world's largest candy maker. Hershey's board rebuffed the approach from Mondelez. Today, its stock price is around $240 because of what happened next. The new CEO, Michelle Buck, set out her vision, including reduced growth in the international market and a focus on the North American market. So her corporate strategy, instead of competing against varied global tastes, which we've talked about, you've got to adjust your marketing mix to the cultural tastes of those countries you're in, and instead of competing against established brands in those other countries, Hershey's pulled back internationally and shifted the playing field to where it already had the advantage, the U.S., well, North America. The company then extended its dominance at home, where the maker of Kisses and Whoppers commands a 46% share of the U.S. chocolate aisle. So global business strategy and domestic strategy all in one. In its new strategy, it first tried mixing candy with beef jerky. That didn't go so well. Hershey's deal for the artisanal beef jerky maker Crave Pure Foods in 2015 signaled to Wall Street that the company had bright ambitions, but Hershey's would have to eat chocolate-covered crow. Crave was sold back to its founder in 2020, but the company was not deterred from diversity, but not all corporate plans do work out. Soon, it tried again, this time with popcorn. Anyone who's been to the movie theaters could have predicted that Hershey's and popcorn would be a much better fit. In 2017, the acquisition of Skinny Pop went very well and pushed Hershey's to acquire Pirate's Booty in 2018 and Dots in 2021. The company's North American sweets portfolio is generating more revenue than ever. That's good for them. But salty snacks grew faster than sweet for two consecutive quarters. Hershey's expects them to keep growing. Remember the product portfolio management mix, cash cows and dogs and question marks and problem children and stars? This fits into their managing their product portfolio. This version of corporate reinvention worked because at Hershey's, at its core, remains the same. It isn't suddenly trying to become a metaverse company. It's a snack company. Now it just has more snacks. Hershey exploited its relationship with retailers to get those brands into stores and brought its expertise about consumer behavior to their products. The sweet accentuated the salty. So here's a comment on the importance of channel member relationships, getting your new brands out through the channels, and as always, the importance of understanding the consumer. Our next chapter, I'm getting ahead of myself because we aren't going to be done with services today, which is part of the product element of the marketing mix. But this was too good to pass up. Our next chapter is pricing. Who hasn't heard of Elon Musk's exciting adventures with Twitter? And I'm not quite sure about his thinking. But this guy, this writer, criticizes Elon, saying, here's five lessons on how not to do pricing, our next content area, from Elon Musk's Twitter. If you want to see a master class in how not to do pricing, Twitter, under the new owner and CEO Elon Musk, is your go-to case study. It's such a hot digital mess that good marketers can simply take a perfectly inverted approach to Twitter and probably plow through the right course for their brands. Watch, learn, and reverse all five of the following Twitter pricing mistakes. Number one, he says what Elon has done is ignore research and go straight to your tactics. I believe I've mentioned the importance of research from time to time for marketing action. Dad, don't do that. Just make a decision. The point about pricing is that it is one of the P's, a tactical part of the marketing mix that you approach once your research has been completed. Research is crucial because it turns out that running Van Western Drop analysis or conjoint or simply getting a handle on who your customer is and what they think of the value they'll get from your brand really helps when it comes to the price you want to set and how you want to set it. Or you can just skip this step and jump right in with around $20 a month for Twitter Blue and be done with it. Why 20? Why monthly? Why start with Twitter Blue? I don't know. Why not? not the best decision making, we would argue. Marketing research is important to decision making. Second mistake, this writer says, ignore strategy and go straight to tactics. Once you complete your research, you're meant to move to strategy. This takes a little more time, but it means when you get to the pricing decisions, you already have a solid grasp of what your target market is, what they will pay, the source of your value and pricing power, and the objectives you need to achieve. All stuff we'll talk about. Or do it the Elon Musk way. Take over the company and, within the first week, target your blue tick loyalists with a 400% price increase and ask your notable influencers to pony up $240 a year for a verification mark that used to be free. How not to provide customer satisfaction for your audience? Not only did this idea go down badly, it went down badly with the people at the top of Twitter's pecking order, the big influencers, people who actually make the platform interesting for the rest of us nobodies. Something Stephen King eloquently noted in his now famous, infamous tweet, $20 to keep my blue check, blank, blank that, they should pay me. If that gets instituted, I'm gone. Stephen King is not happy with Elon's decision-making strategy. Fine. Elon replies with, how about $8? So, misstep number three. Create uncertainty around the price change. Wobble a bit. Don't just base it on research and set. So Musk's response was, how about $8? This also demonstrates a key error. Having floated the $20 monthly price, Musk then more than halved it after King and others pushed back. The textbook approach to any price change is to call it a price increase, explain why you're doing it, and then remind the customer of the value that you still offer even at this higher price point. And throughout this process, it's imperative that there not be an ounce of indecisive blood in the water. Price will go up. It'll go up on this date. That'll happen for these reasons. Thank you. Waffling, wobbling, going back and forth, throwing out ideas, coming back with other ideas. Not a good way to set your price in the marketing mix for your consumers. Don't worry about framing the price. Just set a price. Price is not the same thing as pricing, and there are three parts to pricing. There is the phase in which the company does the research and decision making to set the price or not. Then there's the resulting price based on your research or just a wild guess. And finally, there's the communication of that price to the market. While all three stages are important, the last stage is the most critical, and it's the reason why we need marketers around the table when prices are raised. Frame a price in the right way with the right context and reference points, and most target consumers will buy. Since we're going to stick with pricing, I define these terms in the next Marketing the News story coming up. Twitter is hopelessly out of its depth. The only reference point any Twitter Blue user had was a service that cost them $4.99 last month. Suddenly it's $8 a month. No rationale, no alternatives to make the new price more compelling, no attempt to frame the new price. You just pay more, a lot more. Brilliant move. Then, thinking about your value, let's focus on the company, not on the consumer. Wrong. So Elon's view, value is about the company, not about the customer. Ultimately, the biggest insight into pricing errors at Twitter comes in Musk's half-baked, half-apologetic explanation to Stephen King. Challenged on the price increase, the chief twit admits that the change will happen because Twitter needs to, quote, pay the bill somehow. In that one short sentence, we see all that is wrong with Musk's approach to both pricing and marketing at Twitter. To understand and excel in pricing and marketing your brand, you must stop looking at your costs or your competitors' prices and master the concept of value. Yes, the organization and its need to generate a profit and sufficient and healthy rate of return is important, but equally important is the market, the consumer, and the need to understand what and how they perceive the offer, what they ultimately make of it, find the price that delivers to both demands, the need for profit and the need for value for the consumer, and success can follow you. So pricing for Musk is currently about how he tries to rescue the phenomenally bad deal that he's made to buy Twitter for $44 billion. But in all the sudden efforts to recoup his losses, he misses the point, the concept of value, which, by the way, was our first chapter, our first week talking about marketing. Prices must also make sense and prove attractive to target consumers. And so far, with only a week at the helm, all Elon Musk has done is made a mess of his pricing, undermined his reputation, underwhelmed investors, confused customers, and demonstrated abject inability to handle this most important of P's, price. A chief twit indeed. So I digress by saying, and I'll just see if you follow the story at all, he laid off thousands of employees. You guys caught that? And then, I think yesterday or today, he announced what about those employees? Did anybody know? Anybody follow what he just did? Yeah. He let a bunch of people go, like half his staff. And then, like today, yesterday, nada? Yeah. He offered a bunch of them, not all of them, hey, come back, because I got to run the company. I got to come up with some new ideas. I got to fix issues and problems, and we don't have anybody left. What are you doing? Yeah, so you fired me last week. Yeah, I'm glad to come back today, or not. So we'll see how this plays out for the poor guy. Yes, ma'am.
Isn't Elon Musk the same guy that, allowed former President Donald Trump back on Twitter?
He certainly wanted to do that. I don't know if he actually reinstituted his what do you call it, account yet or not, but that was one of his big things. He felt that this should be wide open, which, by the way, when the market heard there was one idea that's going to be wild west of communication, advertisers were pulling out in droves. They didn't know who they'd be next to. So he backed off that concept, too. All right, since we're now in the pricing domain, a little ahead of our chapter material, let's think about a concept called dynamic pricing, which we'll talk about when we get to pricing, and how to use it in a particular environment in your restaurant. In thinking about pricing in general, and dynamic pricing in particular, you need to understand three concepts: reference prices, rate fences, and framing. Two of those we just heard about. The reference price is how much people think something will cost and consists of things like the last price someone paid, price seen in advertisements, or maybe what a friend of yours paid. You ever buy something based a little bit on what you heard somebody else paid for the product? You ever have that happen a little bit? That's the reference for it. If the actual price is higher than the reference price, customers are probably going to feel that it's unfair. Think about how the airline industry uses the concept of full fare. Hardly anyone pays full fare, maybe 3 to 4% of customers. But the airlines show other fares as discount off that full fare reference price. So the full fare is the reference price, advertised, listed out there, hardly anyone pays it. You feel like you're getting a good deal. The possible reasons why people pay different prices are called, interestingly, rate fences. Rate fences take five basic forms. People pay different rates because of physical issues, controlled availability issues, customer characteristics, transactional characteristics, and product line differences. But regardless of the rate fence that's used, it must be clear both to customers and employees. It has to be easy to enforce and easy to make and make sense to customers. What's an example of a rate fence? Taco Tuesday, an idea we're familiar with, yeah? So on Tuesdays, we have a day that we refer to for a reduced price from the reference price. Happy hours, that is a time of day rate fence. Restaurant week, senior discounts, coupons, all represent issues around which people will pay less money due to certain characteristics. You need to have reasons for charging different prices, and your customers have to be okay with those reasons and understand them. So rate fences is part of a dynamic pricing structure where people pay different amounts of money at different time periods for different products. And finally, let's talk about framing. As you might imagine, there are benefits of framing the prices as a discount. A simple example would be something like, you pay 20% less on weekdays for our service, rather than saying, and I don't know who would say this, you pay 20% more on the weekend. Arithmetically, they're both pretty similar in terms of what you're going to pay, but how would consumers want to hear it phrased? Probably, you pay less on weekdays, not you pay more on weekends. Even though they're financially, I don't know if they're equivalent, but they're similar, research has repeatedly shown that consumers strongly prefer things framed as a discount. So, consumers hate prices bouncing all over the place without an associated rate fence. That is a logical reason for differing prices. So what could be done to make dynamic pricing in a restaurant more palatable to consumers? Well, time of day pricing and day of the week pricing work well, but there are other approaches. What about pricing based on a loyalty program? A loyalty program provides value to the restaurant by not only helping them build a regular base of customers who come back for loyalty points, but also provide them with customer data that can be used to better target marketing campaigns. So what about offering a discount to loyalty card members that will enhance the attractiveness of the program, help increase membership, and gives you a dynamic price based on customer loyalty? Another approach to dynamic pricing is using price to spread demand out over busy periods. During busy periods, operators often have challenges with fulfilling orders. Have you guys had a situation yet where you go to order something from a restaurant at a busy hour and they're no longer taking web orders? They've shut down for now? Or maybe they're not taking phone orders? They're shut down for now? That isn't what I was hoping for. Capacity issues, they don't have enough staff, it's a problem. But they're also losing your revenue, right? So the labor shortage has made this even harder. Some operators actually turn off online and delivery orders during busy periods because they don't have the capability or capacity to fulfill them in a timely fashion. So they forego revenue and profit opportunity, and you don't get your order. All restaurants have peaks and valleys in their demand. If they can even out their demand, they can generate more profits. So restaurants have used things like happy hours, early bird specials for years to spread out the demand. You could offer a discount to customers who order during posted slow periods, 10% off during these hours, or offer a discount to those who order the day before they want it, so it gives you control over when to prepare the order, allows the kitchen to be able to produce more, and as a result, help the restaurant to generate more profit. The takeaway, consider offering discounts during your slower periods, use the prices during your busy periods as your reference price. This is similar to what hotels do with their rack rates. Rack rates are published rates for one night without any discount, or that's supposed to say premium, and airlines do with full fares. This helps you avoid saying you're increasing your menu prices, but gives you the opportunity to generate additional revenue during your slower periods. So what should you do? Don't be afraid to experiment with prices that vary by demand or loyalty status. Keep an open mind towards dynamic pricing. It holds great potential for you in the restaurant and probably other service industries. So here's some examples that I pulled off. Half-off cocktails during happy hour, Applebee's senior discount, early bird specials, dinner specials on those days of the week, or order your sandwich today before 3 p.m. for delivery tomorrow. We'll have it ready, and I assume there's a discount with that as well. All out there, all ways to dynamically vary your price in these different situations. So again, we're a little ahead of ourselves. We'll be talking about pricing probably next week, but there it is. All right, backing up, we pick up with lecture notes page 178 and page 323 in the textbook. We're talking about services marketing as part of the four P's of the marketing mix, and services related to product. And we actually were in an example of, so we were coming up with an example that is relevant to our last business in the news topic, casual dining industry stop providing value in general. Casual dining restaurants provide full service alcoholic beverages and check averages from $10 to $23 a person. They ran into competition from, quote, fast casual change. Those folks are stealing customers from casual dining. Fast casual chains have no waiters, have higher food quality, and then do fast food chains. So things like Panera, Chipotle, Panda Express, Zaxby's, Five Guys, they would all be considered this idea of fast casual, and they're stealing customers from casual dining restaurants. So what are we talking about? Value, an intangible concept often defined in terms of exceptional customer service. Everybody smiles, everybody's on board, they're helping you out. Exceptional product quality. Our restaurant food is better than the fast food food. Value-based prices, it's less expensive. And so we have to think about the value we're providing against competition for our consumers and the reason that consumers come to us versus the competition. So providing value to restaurant customers, value means different things to different people, right? Customers want more than just a bargain basement price. They equally demand decent portions, new exciting flavors. So, menus for value-minded prices include things like Taco Bell's combo meal, $5 meal boxes, and inexpensive a la carte items. Who's a Taco Bell fan? Run for the border, Taco Bell. You like their prices as well as their food? Prices are nice, too. Food's good, but McDonald's dollar menu, items at $1, $2, and $3. How many people are McDonald's fans? Okay, like the price points there, too, as well as the food, but the price is nice. Subway rolled out a $4.99 foot long. Healthier choices, a different way of providing value or social responsibility. McDonald's and Taco Bell have removed artificial preservatives from many items. Starbucks and others are banning plastic straws for environmental reasons, a different sort of value some consumers like. Online ordering systems and self-service kiosks These improve the speed of ordering and getting food. I do take a little exception to that, although I'm sort of a techie guy. Have you been to any of these kiosks with the big menus and you're pressing around and trying to find what you want and the special and the and you're going, what? Hasn't happened to any of you? At some point I'm going, what? Where's? How do I? So for some of you young folk, it works really well. For some of us older folks, I'm going to go up to the window and make the order because I can't find the sub menu. But a lot of people like that. Different segments are out there. Faster payment methods, Apple Pay, smartphone apps, pay at the table technology, all provide convenience for customers. About 69% of Gen X and Y would prefer to pay through pay at the table, and 66% of boomers would prefer it. So I don't have to wait for that waitress or staff person, waiter, waitress, whatever we call it, service personnel to come to my table. Boom, boom, boom. I check in, I'm gone. Competitive positioning. As you think about how you're going to make yourself of value to consumers, your service image is conveyed to the consumer by your service products. These should be things that are valued by your customer. So, Cheesecake Factory, what do you think other than cheesecake? What do you think of when you think of Cheesecake Factory? Anything pop to mind? Anybody ever hear of Cheesecake Factory? Anybody awake? Webby, is you awake? Cheesecake Factory, anything? I guess they don't have a very strong service position, so we would argue maybe large portions. All right, let's try it again. Outback Steakhouse, what comes to mind? Thank you. Okay, so high quality grilled steak, if you agree, could be their service image, what makes them stand for unique. And when you think of Cheesecake Factory, you probably don't think high quality grilled steak, do you? Probably not. How about Olive Garden? What comes to mind? Yes, yes, the endless breadsticks, and we'd also say Italian, Tuscan-like ambiance, and the breadsticks, yes. So these are things that are the position for this service. Why are you blinking on and off? For this service to the consumer and causes somebody to go to your place rather than somebody else's. Consumers also want lower prices. Casual dining was initially successful because it provided better food quality than did fast food at very reasonable prices. But recently, fast food's quality has gone up. Their prices have been rising relatively slowly, but casual dining prices have risen quite a bit while the food quality and innovation has stagnated. Whoops, slipped our positioning. Ruby Tuesday, for example, is upgrading its food, but compared to others, its prices are still pretty high. Do consumers want what they're offering? Improved service. How many of you guys have at some point gotten really impatient with waiting for your staff person, your wait person to come or the food to come out? Enough already. I'm ready to go. Yeah? Not what people are looking for, of course. Discourteous staff. I was down in Columbus for some meeting one time, and I guess I really didn't have the Ohio State mentality, and the service person was just grumpy as heck. Not exactly what I'm looking for in my restaurant serving staff. So finally I said, are you okay? Is everything all right? Turned out the Ohio State had lost a football game that day, and so she was just off the thing. She was not gonna be a happy person. Discourteous staff, not what we're looking for. Chili's is trying to cut 15 minutes from its 45-minute lunch by testing BlackBerries that connect directly from the server to the kitchen. That's probably iPads by now. Chili's is also improving its employee hiring practices, and the staff is wearing more professional-looking aprons, improved service and ambiance. Consumers want better-looking stores. An awful lot of stores are more than 20 years old. Ruby Tuesday has redesigned all of its company-owned stores. Contemporary designs, lighter colors to make it appeal to people. Lone Star is replacing concrete floors with wood, installing oak tables to be better looking. Maybe get kids friendly. Families are a big part of the casual dining industry's market, so could restaurants have a kid playground? When you think kid playground and food, what do you think of pretty quickly? McDonald's Playland. Did you ever as a kid want to go to McDonald's because of the Playland? Yeah. So could you do something similar? I don't know. In a casual dining environment? Or could you have loaner handheld video games for the kids that came in and didn't bring theirs with them? So from a recent study, what are consumers looking for in the casual dining experience? Food quality, cleanliness, service, value. menu variety, atmosphere, craveability, reputation, and something that we are likely to recommend. All things that more or less touch on our service position in the marketplace. So it seems to connect with what we've been saying. What about your hotels? Last week we were talking about the hotel view as a service industry. People want plush pillows and breathable bed linens, soft oversized bath towels, full-size pH-balanced toiletries, complimentary refreshments, and a little something special. How about a plate of homemade cookies or a welcome cocktail or fresh flowers in the room? Any of these might help set you aside, provide value for your hotel service compared to the competition. When we talked about new products coming out, are you going to be the leader, the innovator, or are you going to be the follower? You ask the same question when it comes to services. Are you going to be a leader or a follower? Are you going to set the service standard or wait for competitors to set the standard and then follow their lead? Until recently, Apple was seen as an innovator. More recently, Microsoft has shown some leadership. How's that going to play out for each of those companies? Followers, of course, can become leaders, so you may hang back, come in on something, and then become a leader later on. So, how do we provide excellent customer service? Provide multiple lines of communication, in person, on the phone, by web, through social media. When there's an issue or a problem then, respond quickly to the problem and thoroughly. Get it done. To understand what your customers are going through, walk a mile in your customer's shoes to really understand how they experience your service. Ask them for feedback, and then focus on the relationship you have with the person, not just making the sale. So happy customers are repeat customers. If you show them how important they are to you before the sale, during the sale, after the sale, they're more likely to come back to your business again and again. So exceptional customer service is going to help you be more successful. We good with notes? It can differentiate you from your competition. Good services attract and keep customers. Good service can recover lost sales. You enable people to act to fix problems. Service quality is related in strong ways to your customer satisfaction. And customer service, investment in customer service, usually leads to a profitable return on investment over the long term. Anybody like a particular establishment, retail outlet, service provider because of the service that you get from them? Yeah, can you say what it is or name it? El Jalapeno? Oh, French. Spanish. Okay, and so they have really great service. They're on top of it. They're friendly. It makes it worthwhile going to them. Are they the cheapest place you can get Mexican? Probably not, but I'm willing to pay a little more because the ambiance, the atmosphere, the way they make me feel, the service they provide. Thank you for sharing. Where is the restaurant?
It's Niles, Ohio.
Where?
Niles, Ohio.
Next time I'm there, I'll look them up. Thank you. All right, so it's worth it to me, even though it's a little more, not the cheapest place in town because of the service they provide. So how do consumers evaluate services? In products, it's pretty easy. You take that shovel, you bang it on the ground, you see if it's solid or not. How do you evaluate a service? So we say that the purchase process involves search properties, experience properties, and credit properties for services. Search properties are what the consumer can judge before they purchase the service. It's a little hard, though, because it's not like picking up the shovel, banging it on the ground, seeing if it's solid or not. How do you evaluate a service? Well, oftentimes we use price. What's the basic assumption about quality and price? If the price is high, then? What's the assumption between quality and price? If the price is high, then? If the price is high, the quality is low? How many people feel that's true? So what's the other choice? If the price is high, the quality is high. How many people think that's true? This is not the hardest essay question you're going to have today. All right, so in general, if you can't evaluate something, one thing you might look to is the price. If it's more expensive, maybe that means it's better. So maybe that service that costs more is better. Location. Is this thing in some sort of strip mall? Is it off in its own freestanding building? Is it part of a big mall complex or office complex? Where are they located? It might give you a hint about what's going on. The appearance of the physical facility itself. Have you ever been in a doctor's office or a waiting room or a dentist's office where they got the floor's a little dirty, the magazines look pretty ratty? Have you ever had that experience? No? Yeah? Sometimes it just makes you wonder what's going on in the back room. That's as good as it is. The paperwork, how easy it is to fill out, might make you feel that this is going to be a good service. Again, in the medical field, have you ever gone from one doctor to the next doctor that you're being referred, and the second doctor doesn't know anything about you? You have to fill out all the forms again from scratch. Have you had that happen? Really? Really? You can't? I'm referred to you. You have all this information. I indeed had a while ago a little procedure done at the second place. I'm waiting to fill out all the paperwork. They say, Mr. Marks, yes. They said, here, would you just check and make sure all this is right? All the forms filled out correctly. And how did you think that made me feel about what would happen next? Pretty good. Good indicator that you know what you're doing. Interactions with the service provider's staff. Again, they're friendly, they're useful, they're helpful. A second way to evaluate services is after the search properties, experience properties. These are things that you can judge, evaluate only during or after the service experience itself. How comfortable were you during that root canal, massage, whatever it is? Does the staff seem to be concerned about how the process or procedure is going? How long did you have to wait for your food at the restaurant? You can't tell these things in advance, right? Excuse me, I got to have a talk with this thing. Why don't you just move this over here out of my way? Stop annoying me. Sorry. Wait time. So you can't judge that in advance, right? Where was I? Lost my train of thought. So you go to a restaurant one time. They're quick. They're good. They're friendly. The food is good. Good experience. Then you recommend it to somebody else, or you take somebody else to this place, and it isn't a good experience. You ever have that happen? Well, I don't know what happened here, man. Last time it was great. But you can't evaluate that until you're in the experience. And then we have the idea of credence properties for services. These are attributes inferred from a subjective evaluation of the whole process after it's all done. So was the root canal a success and you felt better? Was the food served properly on time by a friendly staff? You can't know this stuff until it's all done. So we say that consumers use search, experience, and credence properties to evaluate services. And if you start on the left-hand side of this little diagram, there's stuff that you can judge easily in advance of actually making the purchase. So in a store, at least, clothing. Can you judge it before you buy it in a store? Yes, I can pick it up. I can taste it, touch it, feel it, smell it. I can put it on. I can see how it looks. Easy to evaluate before I make the purchase. We move along to the idea of cars. Not quite as easy as clothing. I can take it for a test drive. Who knows how it's actually going to work over the long run, but I should be able to judge quite a bit about this. Vacation. Who's gone on a vacation thinking you researched it pretty well and it wasn't what you expected it to be? Anybody have that? Yeah? Okay. I thought I researched it. I talked to people. I saw it online. Look good. Not so good. Why? Because you can't evaluate the whole vacation till you take the vacation. And then we get way out to the right-hand side. How are you going to evaluate the auto repair you're going to get before you actually take the car in and get it fixed and see if they did the job? Hard to do. And finally, something like a medical diagnosis. Hard to evaluate in advance before they do it. So we have search properties, experience properties, and things that you really can't judge until it's all done, these things that are high in credence properties. Knowing where your service stands on these things allows you to think about how you might communicate information to the consumer about your value, about what to expect. So how are we going to design our services? Well, first of all, think about your customer, right? Who are your customer? What do they want in terms of service from you? Did we already talk? Yeah, we already talked about a fitness center previously, didn't we? So what are some things that people might want from a fitness center, even though we already talked about it? What might people want as a service? Yeah. They might want to lose weight, right? Some other things. Again, this sounds old to me, but go ahead. See, what is it? A personal trainer, okay? So those are quite different audiences that you'd have different things to communicate to them. So what about the nature of the service itself? If the service is complex, medicine, investing, then you got to have a lot of support services. You better have very highly qualified customer contact information, 24/7 maybe, built into your service design. On the other hand, if things are less complex, like automated services or ATMs, where's our closest ATM to us right here? Where's our closest ATM? Just outside of Bowman. Have you seen it, freestanding? Think what it must take to have a freestanding, out in the open ATM in Northeast Ohio weather, working 24/7 for you flawlessly, because nobody wants the ATM to eat their card or not give them back money, right? That doesn't require a lot of personal interaction. You just want it to work. If that's the sort of product you're talking about, you need to spend a lot of money up front making sure the thing is designed solidly to provide the service it's intended to provide. Pricing can be hard because services are not like physical products. What's it worth? Well, first of all, who's the target audience? How do they view you? What are they willing to pay? How much do they buy of whatever you're offering? How often do they buy? For example, TGI Fridays trains workers to offer its loyalty program of discounts and promotions for those people who are regulars and who come back regularly. Regulars who receive this special attention actually increase the frequency of their visits. They feel special. They feel like they're recognized and treated right. And regulars spend significantly more per average check. So figure out who those good customers are and give them special customer service. What type of service are you offering? That's going to influence your pricing as well. Whatever service you're offering, can you justify a fee for it? I think we talked about the folks over at Timken were offering free services on maintenance for highly expensive equipment that had their roller bearings in it. And eventually they said, wait a minute, this is valuable to people. I bet they pay for this free information. And so they set up a whole service area built around giving people information on how to maintain their very expensive equipment. A fee was justified. As you go to pricing, keep in mind the things that have to go in, the expenses, like the wages that it takes to support whatever it is you're talking about. The investment brokerage, the ATM machine, the physical facilities. Are we talking about a real estate office or an amusement park? Technology and equipment that it takes to keep your service offering going. How much it's going to cost to honor your warranties and your guarantees. All of these things have to be included in your pricing. How complex or how much uncertainty is involved when the service product is complex or customers are uncertain about the purchase, they may need extensive sales assistance before, during, and after your sale. Demonstrations of your product related to your service. You are offering a innovative kitchen designs for homeowners. That's what you're offering. Your service is your design offering, right? That's pretty hard to show people. Hi, I'm going to give you a design. But what can you do to demonstrate the design offering that you're going to have, the service you're going to give them? What could you do? Pretty soon I'm going to start walking around the room and pointing it. Oh, good. Thank you. I was saying I'm going to start walking around pointing it. You, answer the question. All right, here we go. What could you do in this environment that we're talking about to demonstrate this service? You could have mock-ups. You could have brochures. You could have product samples. You could have testimonials from other people. You could have a computer model to demonstrate this very abstract idea of designing the product. Service guarantees makes people feel good about your provision of whatever service you're talking about. Think about designing that in as well. After sales assistance, pre-purchase information, all of these things help the consumer to believe in you a little better. Now, if you are a big company, you can do this all yourself. What if you're an entrepreneur, a small business, you only have a couple people working for you? How are you going to do all of this stuff? Smaller marketers may need to outsource some customer service to save costs. Now, there are pros and cons to outsourcing your customer service. Pros and cons to outsourcing your customer service. What do you think a disadvantage might be of outsourcing your customer service? Anybody on this third of the room, what might be a disadvantage of outsourcing customer service? Don't be shy. Anybody help these poor people over here? My go-to man. What might be a disadvantage of outsourcing customer service? Won't be as knowledgeable as your own people will. You lose control over them. You tell them what they should be doing, but you don't own them. They go do whatever they want to do. Advantages. Advantages of outsourcing customer service. Anybody. That whole side fails. Anybody. This whole side fails. Apparently, it's just you and me. Any advantages to outsourcing customer service? Why would you want to do that? Someone mumbled something. Yes. Well, so that you don't have to. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to manage it. It could be less expensive for you to outsource it. Is that what you're going to say over here somewhere? It's exactly what he was going to say. So when would you use customer source outsourcing? When you're about to significantly grow and it's going to be really difficult for you to manage it. It's going to be a whole growth. You're going internationally. You're offering a new service entirely. It's going to be a huge growth. You can't manage it. Saves money. It might be cheaper for them to do it than for you to do it. You want to do it yourself, but first you want to see how it works. So you might outsource it to test and learn what works best. You have variable income, variable volume. Sometimes you need a whole lot of customer service. Sometimes you need hardly any. You're going to be like Elon Musk, fire people. Just outsource it. Let them worry about it. Your business model is shifting to something entirely new and different. And so you need to focus on that, not the customer service itself. Quite a number of years ago, for better or worse, Kent State outsourced its help desk services. So I think they're somewhere in Florida or somewhere. It doesn't matter. So when you call the help desk, you're often getting somebody somewhere else. But they're also saving $1 million a year. How many services should you offer? Well, you're going to focus on the services that make a difference in the customer's purchase decisions. So you have to understand the customer. What are they looking for your product? What matters to them? Those are the ones you're going to focus on. And, of course, we want to keep in mind that customers might be willing to pay for some or all the cost of those add-on services that you're going to offer. Should you be full service or self-service? Well, one more time, it goes back to what your customer wants. You have to keep going back to your customer, folks. How many of your parents love the idea of self-service in the grocery store? They want to do it themselves. Let them through the line. How many of your parents do not want to go through self-service? I'm here. Let somebody do the work. That's what I'm paying for. Different audiences want different things. What do your audiences want? Self-service. Full service, what's the cost going to be to maintain each for you? What can you support? It's going to be an issue as well. In order to be successful with service delivery, you need a commitment from the top of the company. You can't just say to the first frontline people, go do service stuff. That doesn't work. You have to be committed to it. Last time we talked about treating employees as internal customers, making sure they understand their role, what your value statement is, how they're going to be important to delivering your promise to the customers. Here's five lessons from Trader Joe's. How many of you guys know Trader Joe? From Trader Joe's unbeatable customer experience. You know, if it wasn't for marketers, this would be a lot easier. Customer Joe's, Trader Joe's leads in customer satisfaction and employee engagement. They have incredibly loyal customers, but they invest in employees that creates happy atmosphere where workers want to help customers with a smile. Treat employees as your internal customers. View service as a performance. And let your employees know they're in the show of making consumers feel welcome, etc. Who knows what Disney World, Disneyland calls their employees? Yeah. Did I see a hand? No? They call them the cast members. You're not an employee, you're a cast member. Why? Because you're putting on a show. Every day you're out there, you have an audience around you, you're putting on a show for your employees. Did you work there? Or? Okay, you just happen to know it? All right. Ensure service recovery. If an error occurs, fix the error. If you don't fix the error, the consumer is probably lost to you. So what is the cost of losing a customer? We say, for every customer who bothers to complain to you, there are 26 other customers out there who don't tell you that they're unhappy. How many of you guys have had a bad experience and not told the company, the brand, that you were unhappy? A lot. You're losing people, right? The average wrong customer will in person tell 8 to 16 people about their unhappy meal, car repair, dental appointment. 91% of unhappy customers won't purchase service from you again. It costs about 5 times more money to attract a new customer than it would have been to keep the old one. I think I told you, I know I told you about my brother's latest experience with the food delivery service. So earlier, my brother moves from Pittsburgh. Where's my Pittsburgh? Somebody up there is Pittsburgh. Moved from Pittsburgh to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. When you move from the northeast to the south, they say, dump all your furniture. Don't keep anything. Get everything new because it's a new living environment. Okay, fine. So now you're in a new place. You get all new furniture. He's ordering all this stuff online, the way one does, and it's coming shipped to him. And he gets like 4 bar stools, and 3 of them, they're all put together. You have to put them together. They go together, go together, go together. The fourth one, man, it's not working. It won't go together. He's getting a little feisty about the whole thing. He calls up the company. Hey, this bar stool won't go together. He's expecting a bunch of guff from them. They say, okay, sir, very sorry, we'll send you a new one. He says, oh, okay, thanks. What do you want me to do with the old one? Now he's thinking he's going to have to pack it up, ship it out. They say, keep it. Do you think he was relatively happy with the end result of that service interaction? Yeah, he was. He was pleased. It didn't work. They admitted it. They made it right. And they didn't even make him send back the old one. They sent him a new one. What would the alternative have been? Sorry, sir, you're not doing it right. Sorry, sir, we can't help you. Yeah, we can send you a new one, but you're going to have to pack up and pay for returning the old one. None of those happened. He ended up being a pretty happy customer and continued ordering from the company because they had a service recovery plan in mind that kept the customer happy. Each one of your customers has a circle online of 250 people or more. And those folks are going to hear bad things about you, too, if you don't make it right. This is a supposedly true story about a restaurant situation. So 2 Outback Steakhouse ex-customers have not been back since a server and a manager argued with them at the table very publicly about how a steak was cooked. I don't know what the detail was, but they said to the server, they said, I'm sorry, I wanted this medium rare, it's medium or medium well. And then they argued with the customers about it and brought the manager over to argue with them about it. These people are done with you. They're not coming back. What's the simpler thing? Sorry, sir, may I take it away and bring you back one that's done medium rare? So, when you get bad service, you risk the loss of existing loyal customers. They're pissed off. Loss of potential customers who hear bad things about you from your upset customer. You have to deal with the cost of gaining replacement customers, 5 times more expensive to get a new one than to keep an old one. You can have a loss of profit. Your reputation is going to be hurt. And if you're really bad, employees don't like you either. You're not taking care of the customer. You're not taking care of the employees. They're ready to go. Anybody ever work in an environment where things are so bad, you're ready to go as an employee? Yeah, thank you. You're not doing a good job. I'm gone. So none of this is good. So what do you do in a positive sense? Listen to the customer. Get them to talk to you about how things are going. Think in advance about where things can fail. When there's a problem, act fast. Train your employees on what to do. Empower that front line to make a decision, a positive decision, to solve the problem. Then, if the problem can't be solved on the fly, close the loop. Get back to the customer. So you've asked them to talk to you. They talk to you. They file an issue. They file a complaint. They send you an online thing. They don't get back at all. That's not good. Or they get back and say they're going to do something, and they never do it. Anybody have something like that happen to you? Not good. Not the point. You missed the boat here. So here is one of my personal heroes, a docile, quiet leader and manager, Chef Ramsay. He's going into some restaurants, and he's helping them to refresh. In this particular case, he's helped a restaurant that was having problems rebuild, refresh. They're having a new grand opening. It happens to be on Mother's Day. We'll see how that goes.
It's great to see the dining room full and feel the buzz.
Oh, thank you so much. Lovely.
But on the second sitting, the overbooking's causing a problem. There are just too many people.
There's a table of 19 and a table of 15 and a 14 pretty much coming at the same time. And it's not very good when you've got like 48 people all at once because it's shouting the kitchen.
Nick and Richard have to learn a cardinal rule. Put the customers first, make them feel really special, and build a sense of loyalty.
I don't expect to come out for a family meal after a wait as long as this. It's not a question of fast food, it's a question now we've been here an hour and a half. There we are, we learn, and we don't come back again. That's it.
Have you ever had a chicken carved at your table?
No.
Well, I've not done this many times.
Kim's trying her best, but charming the customers just won't work. They want to eat. Remember, unhappy customers destroy reputations.
And that's an excellent lesson, whether you're selling a service or a product. Unhappy customers destroy your reputation. I'm here for Mother's Day. I brought my mom here. I have my kids. An hour and a half, we're still waiting to eat? That's not the kind of service I was hoping to get on this lovely holiday. Yeah? So think about what you're doing. So if you want to know more, consider marketing 45082, services marketing, for additional information on how to do a good job marketing your service as opposed to your product. So I lied. We are going to get to the next chapter today. I wasn't sure that we would. Chapter 13, Building the Price Foundation. So we're in lecture notes page 189, assuming I have that right. We're back to looking at our framework for strategic marketing management. You remember the early days, 30,000 feet above frontline activity. We've drifted down. We're maybe at the 10,000 foot level above frontline activity, talking about developing the marketing mix. Having just finished up thinking about products or services, we're now going to think about the next P we're going to talk about and just alluded to in our business in the news, marketing in the news, pricing. So, marketing mix, we show it as a circle, product place, price promotion, an integrated plan of action with the consumer as the focus. And now we're on to price. So, let's think a little bit about price. What are we talking about when we talk about price? It's the money or other considerations. For some reason, your textbook likes to think about barter, which technically is a form of price consideration. So money or other considerations, including other goods and services, exchange for the ownership or use of a good or a service. Obviously, prices can vary wildly depending on your target audience. So I start with a little extraordinary example. Anybody know the brand Bugatti? Is that a brand we know? Bugatti, yeah. Anybody know the Bugatti Veyron 16.4 base price of $1.7 million? Something you're familiar with? Yeah. Your dad have one? No. Or the 2021 Bugatti Chiron, the $2.9 million, 1,577 horsepower son of Veyron. What do you get for 2.9 mil? Well, let's take a quick peek at what you get at that price point.
The new Bugatti Chiron.
So what are the key stats? Well, 0 to 62 takes 2.5 seconds, 0 to 124 takes 6.5 seconds, and 0 to 186 miles an hour is bent over and spanked in 13.6 seconds. As for the top speed, that's 236 miles an hour in normal driving mode and 261 when you use the special speed key. The engine's quad-turbo spool up sequentially in pairs from 700 rpm to 2000 rpm, where all of the Chiron's 1179 pound-foot of torque kicks in for organ-splitting acceleration. On the outside, you get the distinctive C-shape on the Chiron sides, active aerodynamics and massive cooling ducts which help feed the hypercar's 11 radiators. Inside, you'll find the finest European leather and a minimalist cabin to help make sure your attention isn't drawn away from the road at over 250 miles an hour. So what does the world's future fastest car cost, you ask? £1.9 million. And if you are serious about getting one on your driveway, you'd better be damn patient. 170 of the 500 Chirons have already been ordered, which means you'll be waiting 3 years to get your hands on one.
What? There are people that actually spend that much money on a car? 3 year waiting list to spend $2.9 million on a car. Crazy. Of course, you could be to Cleveland in 7 minutes if you wanted, and they just did stop 7 cars going 100 miles an hour recently over the weekend on the highway, but that wasn't a Bugatti Chiron. So price, the money that people pay in exchange for ownership or use of a good or service. So what is the importance of price in the marketing mix to the business? Price is the only thing that generates revenue. If that's true, finance people might find little exceptions to that, but that's okay. Let's go with me on this. If that's true, what is everything else that you do? If it's not generating revenue, what is it doing? Creating?
Profit.
Conflict?
Profit.
No, but profit is equal to revenue. Somebody help me here. Minus expensive. And if the only thing that generates revenue is price, then everything else is an expense. Everything else you do costs money. Price is a thing that generates revenue for our purposes. Oh, there it is. Everything else is an expense. Think about the importance of price now to your business, to your marketing mix. What happens to sales when your price is too high? What happens to your sales? They drop relative to what they would have been. So what happens to your profit then? You're losing money if your price is too high, right? What happens if your price is too low? What happens to your profit? It also goes down. If your price could have been higher, then you have it set. You're losing money. So whether you're setting your price too high or too low is critically important, and you're losing money either way. Price is pretty important. Now, for some reason, your book likes to talk about the idea of barter when they talk about price. Barter is the practice of exchanging goods and services for other goods and services rather than for money. In the big world around us, this can make sense in global government businesses. Some country wants to buy a bunch of your farming tractors to grow their agricultural economy. They don't have cash to do it. So they say, well, we don't have cash, but what we have is a boatload of olives. So you work out the details. How many olives are worth this many tractors? You barter it away, You then take the olives and sell them in the open market. You get your money back. They have their tractors. That's the idea of barter. So the price here is olives for tractors. Olives is sort of the price. It also can work in the real world. You have a restaurant, and you have a big glass window looking out into the public, and you would like it cleaned. You really don't want to pay what the window cleaner wants to charge. So you say, I tell you what, it's a great restaurant. You got to admit that. What do you say? I give you a free meal in exchange for you cleaning my window. If they go for it, then you come out pretty good. So when you barter a meal for a service, the restaurant's variable cost, their barter cost, is the price of the food. And for most restaurants, the food costs are typically 28 to 35% of the meal. So say the guy wants to charge you $100 to wash the window. You say, I tell you what, great, but I'll give you a $100 meal. How much does it actually cost you to give that person the meal? $33. You win. You got a clean window cheap. They win. They got a $100 meal. Yeah? So that's the idea of barter. Works a little differently than it does for governments. So the price equation that we're going to think about is that your final price charged to your consumer is based on the list price that you've determined minus any incentives or allowances you're giving the consumer for making this purchase, plus any extra fees you charge them. Final price is not always what we call things, but in the case of a new car bought by an individual, we think about that final price. What's that equal to? Well, the manufacturer's suggested list price minus any rebates you might get for buying the car at a particular point in time. It's the end of the season. The inventory is running out. We will give you a rebate to buy it. Cash discounts. Trade in on your old car. So those reduce the list price that you're going to pay. Plus any extra fees, financing charges, special accessories, destination charges. Most recently, inflation charges because we want to and can. That was an odd additional fee. So we bought several cars from Toyota here in Kent. In my latest version, I think it was the latest version, it doesn't matter. My wife buys the car, but it does not come with heated seats. So she says, I really like that car. Can you add heated seats to the car? What do you suppose they said? No. They said, sure. We can have somebody down the road here add the heated seats for an additional fee. You know my wife by now. She said, yes, please. And so we got heated seats for the additional fee added back into the price. Yeah? All right. When we talk about college, we don't typically talk about, quote, the final price. We talk about your tuition. You're familiar with that concept. What is your tuition? Well, your tuition is equal to the equivalent of the list price. We'll call it published tuition, minus any incentives and allowances, such as scholarships, other financial aid, or discounts for the number of credits that you take. And then to that, we add any special activity fees. If we talk about channel distribution in the B2B world, the merchandise bought from a wholesaler by a retailer is called the invoice price. That's the list price minus things like quantity discounts, cash discounts, seasonal discounts, functional trade discounts, plus any penalty you have for making a late payment. So let's take a look at one example. This is the Kent campus tuition rates for the academic year 2021-2022. Seems like I should have updated that. I wonder if I did update that. Anyhow, it doesn't matter. The point's still the same. So here we have the undergraduate tuition guaranteed program. And for one credit hour, it's $471.73 plus $87.27 general fee, $6.96 career services fee. So the undergraduate tuition plus the fees is $565.96. The price per credit hour posted is $565.96. So if you take two credit hours, it's two times that number, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, up to 10 credit hours, you pay 10 times the base rate, $5,659.60. So your price per credit hour off this program, $565.96. Yeah? So it's the base price plus general fees. So at this point, we don't give you any price incentive. Up to 10 hours, you pay $565.96. Tell you what I'm going to do. If you will take more than 10 hours, if you'll become a full-time student, oh, I see, for a part-time student in a three-credit hour class like mine, the three-credit hour class is $1,697.80. If we have 28 classes, you're paying $60.64 to ignore me during each one of these lectures. All right, so now let's jump ahead. We're going to give you a little price incentive. So we were at $565.96. If you take 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, or 18 credit hours, we're going to charge you, after 12 hours, a flat fee. So what does that mean on a per credit hour basis? Your per credit hour drops and drops and drops and drops and drops down. At 15 hours, you're only paying $450.71 per credit hour. At 18 hours, you're only paying $346.43 per credit hour. So we have actually begun to offer you a discount, a quantity incentive. So the quantity incentive, the tuition stays the same over that time period, but as you add up the quantity, it gets less and less and less under the $565.96 per credit hour. Don't bother to thank me. I'm happy to help you out with that price discount. So 11 to 18 credit hours gives you a discount on each class you've taken. And now a 15-hour full-time student is only paying $44.54 for each one of my 28 classes. Discount. So for a full-time in-state student at 15 credit hours with a $1,000 scholarship and the discount rate, what do we have? Base price. $565.96 times 15 hours is a base price, $848,940. We're going to give you a scholarship of $1,000. That reduces you down. We're going to give you an incentive discount that I just described to you of $2,253.68. Have to think about any special fees that would come in. So here's some special fees that you might pay. So we're going to have an $85 college fee. We're going to add in a $45 distance learning fee. So what is your tuition? It's the published tuition minus incentives and allowances plus any extra fees. And in our case, we're going to get it to $5,365.72 as that final tuition based on all this using our price equation. And I think that's probably a good place to break for this lecture. This then ends the material for mini test 10, which is then also the end of the material for midterm 2. We all good? Wunderbar. Enjoy the extra 3 minutes I gave you today and the wonderful weather. See you next time.